Hi there, Greg Van Beek. This is Nancy O'Dell, and I wanted to say congratulations on 500 episodes of Nostalgia Radio Time. That is awesome. And you're also celebrating 10 years. I mean, that's quite the anniversary. Very impressive, Greg. I love me some oldies but goodies.
Once I had a secret love. Ha, I'm Lori Morgan, and if you love pop standards as much as I do, you'll want to tune in each week to Nostalgia Radio Time, hosted by my friend Greg Van Beek.
Go, Joe, go!
Hi everyone, this is Katie Couric, and I want to welcome you to one of my favorite programs, Nostalgia Radio Time, hosted by my friend Greg Van Beek.
Thank you, Katie, and welcome to show number 582 of Nostalgia Radio Time. This week we've got another special guest named Carol joining us on the program. Last week we had Carol Burnett. This week we've got Carol Shaw. Probably not quite as famous as Carol Burnett, but Carol Shaw had an interesting occupation. For 13 months in 1983 and 1984, she was one of Bob Hope's personal secretaries. And she's written a book about the experience called Bob Hope's Bungalow, Tales from the Typing Trenches. So it gives me great pleasure to welcome to the program Carol Shaw.
Oh, absolutely. I was looking forward to it, so I'm thrilled.
Oh, I'm certainly thrilled too. And having been a fan of Bob, or I should say Mr. Hope, for as far back as I can recall, I especially enjoyed your book and the inside scoop you shared. In fact, for Christmas 1983, I received a Betamax VCR from my grandparents as a Christmas present, and I began taping Bob's specials as they aired from then on. And I remember especially the 1983 Christmas show because Bob used a video of Bing Crosby performing Do You Hear What I Hear from 1965. I was 11 years old at the time and already a huge fan of both Bob and Bing.
Gosh, yeah. Well, to date myself.
No.
So you actually got the job of working for Bob Hope through a Help Wanted ad, of all places, and really had no idea who you'd be working for until you went for your interview.
Yeah, I had no idea. I kind of guessed it was one of the comedians because it said, must have sense of humor. So that was a big headline. And I was thinking, oh, who could it be? Could it be Jonathan Winters or, you know, somebody down the block? Or was it Bob Hope? That's impossible. You know, Bob Hope is like the king of comedy. So I was shocked.
Yeah, I'm sure when you got the address, it was kind of a clue for you in that neighborhood that's where a lot of those people were living, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And just driving over there, I mean, you know, you just get off the road there off of, I forget what the street was that I turned off of, but it was right in the, you know, that area, and all the mansions were in that area. And luckily there was the sign on the, you know, on the board. And I realized, wow, this is going to be big.
Well, your first time meeting Bob Hope was certainly memorable, and so let's get this out in the open, so to speak. Your first meeting with Bob gave you quite a glimpse into the private side of Mr. Hope. I guess I got to have you tell that story.
Oh, my God. It was like, you know, the third day, and I was called by him. He says, I've got something that you have to bring upstairs. So I was bringing it upstairs, and then I, you know, put it at the bottom of the, you know, the stairway, the top of the stairway. And then I was walking back, and he said, he came out of his office, I guess it was his office, just my mouth actually was like, you know, I was like in shock, total shock. And when I saw him, it was like, you know, I was like hand down. I was like, he doesn't have any clothes on. Oh, my God. I've only worked for lawyers before. This guy had no clothes on at all. So it was kind of shocking to see that.
So just so everyone's clear, we're not talking traditional boxers or briefs here. This was something that barely covered what every 80-year-old man should always keep covered, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And, I guess I was just thinking to myself, well, how did I get in this mess?
Do you think he just wanted to catch you off guard? Do you think he planned it that way, or do you think he was rushing around and just wasn't thinking about it?
I think that was the latter. He was rushing around. He wasn't thinking about it. He opened the door. He's standing there with his agent, and I'm like, my mouth was like wide open, and everything had stopped and in time. Standing there like, wow.
And I'm sure the agent was used to it, so probably had that happen all the time.
Yeah, you know, he'd seen everything, so I love it.
Just one big happy family at the Hope compound. So how many other secretaries were there in this bungalow just off of Bob's mansion?
Yeah, it was in his mansion, and it was, you had to go through there to actually walk through to get to the driveway, which is on the other side of the mansion. And there was, let's see, Marie and Nancy and, of course, me and Kathy, who is secretary number one. She was there, and, well, actually she wasn't there because he had called me right at 9 o'clock when I, you know, walked in the door. So he wanted stuff and he wanted it now. So he had to rush over there, of course.
Sure.
He walked up the driveway and there you were. It was like, oh, it was kind of nerve wracking a little bit.
Well, was there a secretary named Joanne Kennedy working there at the time you were there?
Joanne Kennedy. I don't recall a Joanne, though.
Okay, because I looking back through the things I got, and the first time I wrote to Bob was in 1990, but around this time, and I got a letter back signed by Joanne Kennedy with just we think he's pretty great, too, and, you know, just a friendly thank you for my letter type thing.
Oh.
She must have been one of the secretaries that came along after you had left.
Yeah, she probably did, because he had a ton of secretaries, like, they're waiting at the door, pretty much, you know, to work for him. So, everybody, you know, that worked for him was in awe. Let's put it honestly, they were in awe.
As the dogs bit them, you had to keep replacing them, right?
Yeah. The dogs, oh, my God, the dogs were the scariest thing of all, and I never thought anything of it when I'm petting them in the interview, thinking, oh, this is a nice dog, not even thinking I'm going to get the job. It was just a, you know, really sweet, you know, dog that just was, you know, kind and friendly, and you know how dogs are, so
sure.
It was kind of shocking to actually, you know, realize this dog could bite your, you know, what off, which he did.
It sounds like it, yeah.
So your main duty each morning was listening to people tell you jokes. Well, more importantly, Bob's writers calling to tell you their latest jokes for you to type up for Mr. Hope.
Oh, my gosh, yeah. Every morning I would start in. The phones were ringing off the, you know, the hook, and the secretary at the front desk was trying to get them down. And so I came in, and then I took over for her, and I'm telling you, the 200 jokes a day was, you know, crazy. I mean, it really was. By the time you add up, you know, all the jokes. Yeah, they had 10 jokes. They had 20 jokes they had to do for him each day. And there were like 10 writers. So it was about 200 jokes a day. So,
wow.
Yeah, it was a lot. It was.
Well, you actually had some very good stories in your book about Robert Mills, one of Bob's writers. I had some contact with him myself a few years ago about the very first Bob Hope special he wrote for, which at the time was anything but funny. I don't think there was any jokes in it at all, because it was a tribute to Bing Crosby, who died 2 weeks prior to its airing. Originally on that October 28th date, Bob was to have had a special on titled Bob Hope's Road to Hollywood, and Bing was supposed to be the guest on the program. He was going to tape it when he returned from Spain, but of course he never returned from Spain. He passed away there. And so Bob shelved that special and did a 90-minute tribute to Bing instead, and he finally got around to doing The Road to Hollywood in 1983 when you were working for him.
Oh, wow. Yeah, I remember. Yeah, I remember Bing for sure. But mm-hmm. I never, you know, Bing Crosby was, you know, had a real reputation. I mean, he was a disciplinarian with his kids.
Right.
And he was very, very strict and kind of,
he was
you know, the opposite of what you see on TV, or, you know, what people would see on TV of him.
Oh, right. He was. I mean, it was more so with his first family. He was a lot more strict. The second family, he was a lot more lenient with him. But, yeah, he was pretty strict.
Yeah, I wasn't there, so, I can't really talk to that. But
sure.
I do remember, thinking, oh, it'd be nice to talk to Bing Crosby because, you know, they were friends. At least have him call in, you know. Everybody calls him. So he had a ton of people calling in.
Sure. Did you ever deal with Barney McNulty?
I did. I remember Barney. Oh, my God. That's a name from the past.
He was another one of Bob's right-hand men. I guess he held up the cue cards at all the TV shows.
Yes, the cue card man. Yes, at NBC. Yeah, he was really, one of the good guys.
Yeah. Did you ever attend any of the tapings of the TV specials?
I didn't. Mainly, you know, being number two. Yeah, I really fight to, you know, get ahead. So Kathy went to all of them. She was always, you know, trying to get in and out and see who was there and, you know, say hi to everybody. But, I never did. I was more or less manning the phones. Yeah, it was great.
Well, it sounds like Armando was truly devoted to Bob, and he was kind of determined to keep Bob from driving at all costs, too.
Oh, God. Well, you know, I'll never forget him. Armando was the first person I had met, and he was the sweetest guy. Honestly, he was so kind and really, really he was just the sweetest man that I'd ever met, really.
Mm-hmm.
And the stuff that, you know, I don't know, he was a little bit older than me, but we used to get into things that we shouldn't have gotten into, but we did. I remember that one at the house. I mean, he said, oh, come on, get some. There's some cookies here. And it's like, oh, let's get the cookies.
Oh, yeah, when you backed over the grill or backed into the grill and barbecue.
Oh, God. I mean, the whole table just went. I mean, I don't know what was going on, but I'm thinking to myself, only me. This is going to only happen to me, right? And it did, of course. It did. Oh, boy. That was something.
Well, that was kind of a shocking revelation to me is that most of the staff actually lived in holy terror of Mrs. Hope. It kind of surprised me because I always thought of her as this sweet grandmotherly like figure. But
no, she was kind of strict and disciplinarian type. Yeah, you kind of had to tiptoe around her because she didn't want, for instance, she didn't want you calling him Bob at any cost. I mean, you know, he was just, for her, you had to call him Mr. Hope, show the respect, and, you know, that's how it was done back in the day of her day. And, you know, that was quite a long day, actually.
Right.
She lived longer than he did, actually.
She did, yeah. She got to be 102,
yeah.
I think.
102, yeah. So she, she did pretty good for, you know, that age.
well, she was always, well, I spoke to her once briefly on the phone when she was recording her last album, but she was kind of very kind to me. I didn't speak to her very much, but because I was working with her music director, Nick Perito, we were picking songs for the album, and Nick would tell me, she always asks about you and says, how is that nice young man doing? And I said, oh, well, that's pretty nice.
That's nice. Yeah, it was really nice. I guess with the men, she was a little bit different than what she is with the secretaries. You know, the secretaries, God knows what they're up to, right?
Yeah, it should be. Do you know what her pet name was for Bob? I bet you don't know this. Gulliver, as in Gulliver's Travels.
I never knew that. Oh,
yeah,
my God.
Well, Nick told me that he attended Bob's wake, and there was a big spread of flowers by his casket, and there's a card on it that said, "To Gulliver, I love you," or something like that.
Oh, isn't that sweet? Yeah, they were quite the couple. Very, very devoted, sort of.
Sort of, yeah.
You know what I mean? If you read the book, you'll understand.
Oh, yeah, the fur coat hiding on the floor of the Chrysler.
Oh, my God, yeah. That whole thing was like, it shocked me because I wasn't expecting. You know, I didn't expect anything, really. I just thought he would be telling jokes all the time. And here he was like, you know, when she was away, the mice will play, right?
That's right. And I had read that somewhere that he actually had a girlfriend up at the time he was in his 80s yet. And that may have been her. So.
That may have been. I think I know who it is, but yeah. Yeah. You'd be surprised.
For many years, way back, it was Marilyn Maxwell. You know?
Yeah, that's what I was thinking of. Yeah.
Yeah.
She was one of the people that lived in, I think, in Toluca, not Toluca Lake, in Burbank, I think.
Right. Well, the other jaw-dropping revelation was the story that Armando told you about George Burns kind of being a bit of a dirty old man.
What? That was outrageous. I couldn't believe him. I was going, are you kidding me? Really? Is this the truth? And apparently, he couldn't do a lot. Right?
I wouldn't think so.
Because he was, you know, if he was, that was Bob Hope was 80, he had to have been up there in his, you know, close to his 90s, I think.
Yeah, he was about 6-8 years older than Bob, I think.
Yeah, that's true. So, well, I was shocked myself that he was even thinking that, but he was, I guess.
But after reading that, it shouldn't be surprising, because I remember in, must have been around 1992, there was a picture I saw in a magazine of George in a tuxedo. He was out to some function, and the date he had on his arm was Sharon Stone, right after she did the movie Basic Instinct.
Oh, my God.
Here's George Burns out on the town with Sharon Stone. He was like 96 at the time.
I know. I can believe that. He just wanted to be close.
Well, the funny thing about it, as he got older, he shrunk, and I bet you he wasn't even 5 feet tall anymore. And she towered over him like two heads taller than him. And he's kind of shuffling along next to her.
That's funny. I can just see the two of them. Kind of a strange plight, right?
Right.
Oh my God. Yeah.
Well, another person who was with Bob for many, many years is Ward Grant. He was his longtime publicist, and I imagine you dealt with him quite a bit.
Oh, yeah, Ward, yeah. He was always, you know, working and running, and it's like, God, relax. I mean, life's too short, but I guess, you know, he had a lot to do, you know. I mean, getting you know, Bob off and running and getting him to do things was another story, you know. He was always... Yeah, kind of a little bit late for everything, but he managed to get him out there. So the one thing I do remember about him was, oh, God, I wanted to, say I was sorry for being so – I was so ornery back in those days. Oh, God, I was always, you know, pushing the envelope like, I don't know. So anyway, I had to apparently – he wanted me to stop by, and I kept putting it off. And then I said, "Okay, I'll stop by." And he said, "No, I'm gonna drive it over. I'm gonna, have him sign it right then, and you don't have to deal with it." So he did. So, yeah.
I had kind of a similar situation with Ward. After that album came out that Dolores worked on, I was trying to arrange a phone interview with her like this to. Promoted on a radio show I was doing at the time, and Ward kept dropping the ball, and we never made the connection. Finally, after I called him several days in a row, he gave me his home phone number, and he told me to give him a call after hours at such and such a time, and he'd have an answer from her. So I called, and he answered without even saying hello. He said, "Damn it, I was in the can, and I missed your call," he said to me. So that's my Ward Grant story.
That's
It was in the can.
Yeah. I can't imagine him, you know, even the thought of seeing him in the can is like, you know, it's kind of...
Well, I admire his honesty, you know. That was the excuse he had that he didn't get her call. He was taking care of business, I guess.
Yeah, he was. He definitely was.
So it dragged on for quite a while. We never did get to do the interview with her, which I kind of regretted, but it was still an interesting time.
Yeah, that's for sure. I guess you weren't, you know, that important at the time, right?
No, I certainly wasn't. You know, it would have been amazing if I would have pulled it off. But another revelation that you had in your book, which may be disheartening to some, is that you actually signed most of the autographed pictures that Bob sent out to his fans.
Oh, yes, I did. I signed a lot of photographs. I can't tell you how many little pieces and, you know, odds and ends and little tiny things. Like, for instance, there was something it was a chessboard, and there was so many little tiny little, I can't even describe it. They were so minute, so you had to pull them out and then sign them.
Every piece you had to sign?
Well, it was quite a scenario. It was a Japanese item that had a whole bunch of different parts.
Wow.
And, signed that. And, yeah, there was a lot of photographs and whatnot. But I managed to take care of it, so that worked.
Was that a talent that you discovered you had, or had you been able to do forgery in the past before you worked
for
Bob?
No, that's forgery. I actually was known as the queen of forgery, actually, if you think about it. No, I'd never done that in my life, and to actually sign his name, I had to practice, you know, for hours on end, and then I would, you know, just get it just so, and then, you know, the next day I'd start again, and, you know, you'd have the signature, and you'd have all the, you know, the little nuances of how he signed his name, especially H-O-P-E, which looked like hot the time I finished. That was the signature looked like hot.
Well, it did, because his signature was all kind of one word, and it kind of ended in almost an R-shaped thing on the end, like Bob Hoper.
Yeah, it was really weird. So that was fun, though. That was doing that was a lot of fun.
Did you add inscriptions, too? Because I have a friend of mine who sent me a copy of a picture he got from Bob, and around the time you were working there, and he wrote, actually, "Thanks for the memory" on the photo. I was wondering if that's something you used to do too, or if it's just you just signed his name.
No, I just signed his name, so that might have been his real signature.
Could be because of the picture of my friend with Bob. They were at some golf event, and he must have sent it into the office and have it signed. So maybe Bob did sign it himself.
Yeah. So you know, you never know. I can tell by the way he signed it if it was him or if it was one of the secretaries, but
mm-hmm. Well, that leads me to my next question. Did any of those scans that I emailed to you of the pictures that I received from the Hope office over the years, do they look like they were genuinely signed by Bob, or do you think one of the secretaries did them?
They all looked authentic, but it's very hard to tell from a photograph.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I was kind of wondering myself. It's like, are these the real deal, you know, I could tell from the originals that the secretaries had signed that there was a difference. And I could tell that there was one big picture that his agent had him supposedly sign it, but I knew it wasn't his signature because you can tell the mm-hmm. way that he signed it that was, you know, bigger than life, and you could tell. You can just tell.
Well, in truth be told, it shouldn't be surprising that people like Bob and Bing did the same thing, have a secretary sign his fan mail, because, my God, they were all so busy traveling around, working, doing various functions. And I'm sure the last thing they wanted to do is spend what little free time they had signing a bunch of pictures. countless pictures. I'm sure there were hundreds of them.
It
speaks a lot for him that he even did that, that he sent pictures out, because today I don't think you could write to anybody and get an autographed picture back in the mail.
Wow. No, and that's a shame, because people, really wanted those photographs. I mean, quite frankly, the little amount that I remember we had to take up stacks of photographs upstairs, and he would sign them. So you knew he was doing it, but he just didn't have enough hours in the day.
So there were some real ones mixed in with the forgery ones or whatever.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay.
Well, I'm sure on many occasions when you answered the phone, you got kind of a jolt because you never know who would be calling. I mean, you had presidents and Hollywood royalty calling. How many presidents did you talk to?
Let's see. I talked to, there was Clinton. And there was George Ford. It was
Jerry Ford.
Yeah, Jerry Ford. I remember talking to him, and he was always joking around with me. Well, whoever picked up the phone, he just, it was one of the secretaries. And Kathy and I spoke. We had the same dialect, I guess. And we had the, I don't know where she was from, but she and I talked very, very similar. And then even the writers, they would say, it is almost impossible to tell you apart, but I had a higher laugh, I guess.
Your laugh gave it away, okay.
Yeah, I laughed a lot. She laughed a lot, too, so we got along pretty good.
Did Ronald Reagan ever call?
Ronald Reagan, did he ever call? I don't recall ever talking to him. I could be wrong, though, on that.
Mm-hmm.
I know I passed along a lot of phone calls because when I, when Kathy came in and I was on the phone, she'd, obviously get the phone, and she'd get half of the calls and I'd get the other half. So.
Well, that's right. In 1983, Reagan would have still been president, so it would have been kind of unusual for him just to pick up the phone and call Bob Hope on his own. Usually, I think when the president wants to get a hold of someone, he has his secretary or some other staff member put the call in first to get them on the line and then transfers them through directly to the president. So that probably would have bypassed you.
Yeah, it could have been a call or two. But I don't recall speaking to him personally.
So no call from Richard M. Nixon either, I don't imagine.
Nixon did not call, but he was always available.
Oh, sure.
Put it that way. He always sent him stuff that he wanted his signature on. So, we always had to send that stuff out to Nixon. In fact, at one time, I remember Nixon had sent something in, and God, I remember signing my name as Bob Hope, signing Bob Hope's name, and it looked just like it. So, and I said, well, there we go. Off it goes.
Yeah, off it goes.
Tell us about the time that you didn't recognize Milton Berle's voice when he called the office.
Oh, my God. That scared me so badly. Oh, my God. He was after me like nobody's business. I mean, he wouldn't let it go. He would not let this go. Just because I couldn't remember, who he was. It's like, I'm going, Milton. I couldn't think of who was named Milton. I'm thinking through my brain, going, I can't think of Milton. Milton. I was thinking, was it a doctor? Was it a, architect? So I don't know. It's like, he goes, Uncle Milty? Oh, Uncle Milty. Of course. I'm slapping my head, going, oh, of course it was you. Yes, Milton. Oh, my God, Uncle Milty. Yes, I remember you. Hello.
You must have caught him in a good mood that day, because he was notorious for being very brash and aggressive and yeah. rude to people.
Oh, he was. Yeah, he were. He really was. He, yeah. I can't say it anymore. But he was kind of scary.
It was around that time, I guess, he hosted an episode of Saturday Night Live, and he was such a holy terror to everybody on the set that they banned him from ever appearing again, and they've never shown that episode again anywhere.
Really? Oh, wow. Yeah. I didn't know that. That's yeah. amazing. Yeah, I yes, I'm glad. I'm glad somebody took a stand. God.
So, anyway. So tell us a bit about Bob Hope's famous joke vault. This, I saw a picture once of Bob sitting in it, and there were just rows and rows of filing cabinets.
Yeah.
And he was sitting kind of in the middle of them.
Yep, and that was part two. I mean, there was the first one, the main part was all the filing cabinets were, and then there was another one, a lock. I had to remember all the, you know, the combinations to get into it. It's like, oh my God. So we had to open those two first thing in the morning because you never know. We'd want a joke from one of those vaults and we'd have to find it. So we had to have both of them opened, and it was kind of a, it was quite a thing.
That must have been amazing because I would imagine that there were jokes probably going back to the, probably late 30s into the 40s when he was doing his yeah. radio show.
Oh, yeah. I mean, he had a ton of jokes. I mean, he saved every single joke, you know.
Right.
Can you imagine all those jokes? I mean, wow.
It had to just been staggering, yeah.
Staggering. It's just staggering when you think about it. These jokes were on this this paper that had been, that had the mimeograph on it. So, like,
wow.
Oh, my God. It was, like, incredible. I understand, at the end, I guess they shipped them all off to the Library of Congress.
Mm-hmm. I think they did, yeah.
Yeah.
Now Bob and Bing, for that matter, was the same way. They were both notorious cheapskates. And ironically, the man who everybody thought was a cheapskate, Jack Benny, was the complete opposite.
Yeah.
He was very generous
in the village. Jack Benny, but yeah, he was something. He was, how can I say it? I guess Bob really worshipped him. Well,
oh,
he
yeah.
worshipped him too.
Yeah.
He thought he was the greatest thing, you know.
Sure.
He was older than
oh, yeah,
Bob.
Jack Benny had passed away probably about 9-10 years before he began working for Bob. I
yeah,
think he died
oh, yeah.
Before.
Yeah, I remember that. But he was quite the comedian.
Oh, yeah. So it was really Bob's low wages that led you to seek other employment after just 13 months. So.
Yeah, I went to Disney right after and got a job there. In fact, I was working for Mr. Beeks.
You were?
His name was Steve Beeks. And, I know. It was kind of funny. It's like, Steve Beeks, okay. So I should, talk about a coincidental thing. But, yeah.
Yeah. So tell us, just in winding up, about your last day working for Bob. That was kind of memorable for you.
Oh, my last day was kind of sad, and yet, I know I had to, get him before he left on his trip, because at 5 o'clock at night, he'd always be getting ready to, in a flurry of packing and stuff, he'd, do all these trips. So at 4 o'clock, I was like, I think it was 4 o'clock, I was saying, don't forget, you've got to, call me. Be sure you call me because, he says, I know this is your last day. I said, yes, I want to say goodbye. Say goodbye. and sure enough, he says, okay, it's 4 o'clock. he said, oh.
Here I am.
here I am. What do you need? And I said, I got to do it. So I sang Thanks for the Memory to him. Oh, my God.
Wow.
First of all, I can't sing. So I was, whoa. I don't know how I did it, but I got the words out. And I sang it to him. And, he was actually kind of humbled by it, I think. he was very quiet. And then he said, you know, I got to really, yeah, thank you for singing that to me. It was really sweet. And I don't know if anybody else is saying it to him, but I did. And,
I was just going to say, you're probably the first one who ever really did that on their last day, so it probably touched him, you know?
Yeah, so it must have, because he was saying, you know, what was he saying? I want to thank you for all your hard work and everything else. And I cut him off as he's going into this, you know, sweet little rendition of, you know, things that I had done and this and that. And,
sure.
And it was kind of sad. It was bittersweet. I hated to leave, but I just didn't see there was a real future for me.
Sure.
Little did I know we'd go on another 20 years, but, you know.
Well, you might have gotten a raise by that time. Who knows?
Yeah, I might have. Not much, but I would have gotten something.
Another 50 cents or so.
Yeah. Exactly.
Well, I've kept you too long already, Carol, but before I let you go, please tell our listeners where is the best place they can go to find a copy of your great book, Bob Hope's Bungalow, Tales from the Typing Trenches.
Oh, yeah. You can read it on Amazon.com or BearManorMedia.com, which is the publisher.
Sure.
And hopefully a lot of people will, you know, do that. I'm hoping.
I'm hoping too, because it's a great little book. It's an easy read. It doesn't, you know, take you 2 weeks to read it or anything like that. It's something you can do in the afternoon.
Yeah, it's kind of cute.
Well, thank you again for being so kind and so generous with your time, and I want to wish you the best of luck with the book.
Oh, thank you so much. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Well, thank you for doing this, Carol.
And my thanks once again to Carol Shaw for joining us on the program. Hope you enjoyed that look into the private side of Bob Hope and how he handled his office. A lot of fun. Time now for Old Time Radio Time. It's here in the show where we give a listen to a complete radio broadcast from radio's golden age. This week we're going back to November 30th of 1954 and tuning into the Bing Crosby Show.
This is Ken Carpenter welcoming you to the Bing Crosby Show, transcribed from Hollywood.
Moonlight becomes you. It goes with your hair. You certainly know the right thing to wear.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. The opener tonight is I Want to Be Happy with Buddy Cole and his outstanding group.
I want to be happy, but I won't be happy till I make you happy too. Life's really worth living when we are merged, given. Why can't I give some to you? When skies are gray and you say you feel blue, I'll send a sun smiling through. I want to be happy, but I won't be happy till I make you happy too. But I ain't gonna be happy till I make you happy too. Life's really worth living when we're mirth given. Why can't I give some to you? When skies are gray and you say you feel blue, I'm gonna send the sun smiling through. I wanna be so happy, but I ain't gonna be happy till I make you happy too.
Seems like anybody with some news about new gadgets or inventions or scientific developments can always get me on the eerie. I hope you're similarly susceptible, because I thought tonight I'd talk about some new things, or at least they're new to me, most of which are amusing and some of them almost practical. Now, maybe you like to practice golf at home, but you never had the room, never had the fairway or the grass to hit the shots off of. Well, they got a new gimmick for you. A parachute golf ball is now available. Yes, sir, you can now convert your backyard or the neighborhood vacant lot into a practice driving range. The parachute is attached to a regulation long-service golf ball, a real dollar ball, a lot of life to it, but on a 20-inch long string. There's little chance of too much distance or breaking the neighbor's windows, because the parachute slows the ball down to a safe speed almost as soon as it's airborne. Makes it easy to find. Tall grass, too. Got to get some of these. Of course, fellow hackers, in order for the parachute to work, you've got to get the ball off the ground. At least 20 inches, too. Now, I got another little item here that has some interest. It's called the wet seat avoider. The owner of a convertible car need have no more shower worries when he leaves his car parked with the top down. Because this new innovation is called the Rain Brain. Quite a title, isn't it? It automatically raises the top of the car as soon as it starts to sprinkle and a few drops of water touch it. Rain Brain is easily installed. It's completely guaranteed. There you are, folks. You can scoff at Mother Nature now. Get yourself a Rain Brain. Now, here's an Eastern firm. They're going to put something on the market that... very provocative. They're called kangaroo suspenders. Now, they're not actually suspenders for kangaroos. Or what do they have to hold up that isn't already being held up? These new kangaroo suspenders will feature built-in pockets for combs and nail files and other items. I suppose you could also carry a ration of Rye Crisp or a stick or two of double mint or some pemmican, postage stamps, calling cards, money. Oh, lots of flat items could be carried there, too. Say, these suspenders might be the end of wallets. Might even kill Hope's money belt. Then there's another thing out. It's called the Hangover Kit. It's a caricature-decorated bag. It contains tomato juice, washcloth, aspirin tablets, mints, ice bag, chewing gum, Alka-Seltzer, and complete instructions on what to do if you wake up with the whips and the jingles after a rather expensive evening. I think it might be a good idea to attach that golf parachute to the ice bag just in case someone does decide to go out a window. Now, I see another little item here, also in the golf field. I'm always interested in anything pertaining to golf. This is called the argument avoider. Well, that's something that you could use in pretty near any game, but maybe it's particularly useful in golf. And it's a little ingenious device which is operated by setting a dial to the hole being played, and you register the strokes as you make them. As the play of each hole is completed, score is automatically locked in, you see. You wear this argument avoider on the wrist, like a watch. All parts are metal. Well, now I know what to give Bob Hope for Christmas. This will solve my gift problem with Phil Harris, too, but I wonder if these lads will submit to these wrist lie detector tests. I'm sure they'll seek refuge back of the Fifth Amendment or something. That's my guess, anyhow. Oh, yes, here's another thing. Before we have some music, I feel that I must tell you about Cornell University and what they've done up there. You know, Cornell has a wonderful agricultural school, I guess probably the finest in the East, and they've developed up there quite an item. It's a firmer, crack-resistant tomato. I wish Cornell would do something toward developing a tomato that tastes like a tomato. That would be important and a worthwhile contribution. Or maybe a seedless watermelon, if they're not too busy up there. Well, then, shall we get along musically? Here's one of the big smashes from Pajama Game. Hey there.
Hey there. You with the stars in your eyes. Love never made a fool of you. You used to be too wise. Hey there, you are
on that high-flying cloud. Though she won't throw a crumb to you, well, you think someday she's gonna come to you. You'd better forget her. Her with her nose in the air, she has you dancing on a string. Break it and she won't care. Won't you take this advice I hand you like a brother? Or are you not seeing things too clear? Are you too much in love to hear? Is it all going in one ear and out the other? Advice I hand you like a brother. Or are you not seeing things too clear? Are you too much in love to hear? Is it all going in one ear and out the other?
Thank you, Buddy and fellas. Incidentally, the boys in Buddy's band are Don Whitaker, bass, Vince Terry, plays one of the several guitars, Nick Fatool on the drums, and of course, Mr. Cole is at the piano, or the Hammond organ, or something with keys, whatever you want. He's got it over there. Well, now, I believe we have time for another song. I think we have here. This is one called Anyone Can Fall in Love.
Anyone can fall in love. Anyone can touch a star. Beggars can be choosers. Winners, though they're losers. Anyone can fall in love. Young or old, the rule applies. When the right one meets your eyes, 9 or 97, you've a right to heaven. Anyone can fall in love. Suddenly the bells are ringing. Suddenly the world seems new. All at once your heart starts singing the way that mine did when I looked at you. Anyone can fall in love. Anyone can touch a star. When my arms enfold you, you can say I told you. Anyone can fall in love. seem so far above me. I never dreamed you could be mine. Now you're saying that you love me, which only goes to prove my opening line. Anyone can fall in love. Anyone can touch a star. When my arms enfold you, you can say I told you. Anyone can fall in love. Oh, anyone can fall in love.
That seems to be it for this session. I hope we can all get together again tomorrow night. Same time, same place. Meanwhile, good night and thank you.
Moonlight becomes you. It goes with your hair. You certainly know the right thing to wear.
This is Ken Carpenter saying goodnight to you all and reminding you that Bing Crosby can be heard Monday through Friday, transcribed from Hollywood.
While you're planning your holidays at home with your loved ones, stop for a moment to think about those unfortunate folks whose holiday may not be as joyous as yours. Unless you help them, they may not have a holiday celebration. Many people overseas need food, funds, and clothing to get through this coming winter. That's why people of all faiths, Protestants, Catholics, and Jews, have banded together to meet the continuing needs of the homeless and hungry abroad. The slogan of the joint approach is, "Keep faith with those in need. Give through your faith." When you give to those less fortunate than you, you'll have a richer, happier Christmas yourself. This is the CBS Radio Network.
Stay tuned for the Amos and Andy.
Go, Joe, go!
And that'll just about put the wrappings on this week's edition of Nostalgia Radio Time. I'm Greg Van Beek. Thank you for listening and hope you'll join me again next week for more music and memories of the greatest generation. Feel free to email me with any comments you have about the program. Hope you enjoyed the look into Bob Hope's bungalow from Carol Shaw. If any songs you'd like me to play or old-time radio shows you'd like featured, send them all to nostalgiaradiotime@yahoo.com. And while you're online, please check out our Facebook group. Join up on our Facebook group, and if you want to send us a tweet, our Twitter handle is @NRTWithGVB. And if you happen to have an interest in antique radios looking to acquire a fully restored and functional set, now many with Bluetooth capability, get in touch with me. Check out my website at www.radioaddict.com/Van Beek. That's all one word, V-A-N-B, two E's and a K, and I've got some great sets available for you for purchase. So until we meet again next week, I'm Greg Van Beek saying so long for now.